Hello and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB 19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy!
So to finish off our trifecta of amazing talks, we have the wonderful Anne Weaver. Anne is an ED consultant and director of clinical trauma at the Royal London Hospital. It turns out she and Neha have a little something in common. It turns out that Anne, too, has been a food critic, and this was when she was a guest judge on the Great British Menu. So to tell us more about managing approach to trauma, we have Anne Weaver.
Thank you, Grace. Good morning, everybody. I'm delighted to be here at Don't Forget the Bubbles. I think it's the most colourful conference that I've ever been to, so thanks for the invitation to speak. Please put your hand up if managing adolescent trauma makes you slightly nervous. Okay, I'm really relieved that some of you feel a little bit uncomfortable about it. Okay, so adolescent trauma is important. We've already heard from Russell this morning that adolescents in their own right have their own unique physiology, psychology, etc. But it's beholden on all of us, even those of us who aren't paediatricians, to make ourselves capable and competent for dealing with whatever might come in through the front door, or if, like myself, you work outside the hospital in pre-hospital care, for whatever might confront you if you believe you can make a difference. So I'd like to challenge you today that I believe we can do better for our adolescent trauma patients. I work in a combined major trauma centre in East London where we see adults and paediatrics. Most of my paediatric trauma practice actually happens outside the hospital as part of my role with London's Air Ambulance. But I still do look after children who are injured and come to the emergency department. If you look at the TARN data for last year, in England, Wales and Ireland, 625 children aged between 13 and 16 were trauma called, admitted to hospital, and 30% underwent surgery of some type, mainly orthopaedic. 25 of those children died. Those TARN figures don't cover Scotland, they don't cover children in that age group who died outside hospital, but 25 of them died. So we know that we must and we can do more. I'd like you to think about your responsibility as individuals within teams and within your own institution, and what can we do to improve the pathway for adolescent trauma patients. I'd like to tell you two stories. They're about two 15-year-old boys. The first is Rayan. Rayan lives at home with his mum, dad, younger sister and younger brother. He's just taken his mock GCSEs, and they finished the GCSEs. He's gone to the park with a school friend, and they're chatting about the exam and other things that 15-year-old boys talk about. They see another group of boys coming towards them who they don't know, and these boys come closer and closer, start taunting them. Ray and his friend get up to move away, and as they move away, Rayan is stabbed through the front of his chest. His friend's mum is a nurse, and his friend runs to their house, which is pretty close, tells his mum what's happened. She immediately phones 999, and an ambulance comes to Rayan, who by then has collapsed a short distance from the park bench. He's still breathing, but he's pale. He's not able to talk. He's clearly struggling. The ambulance service can just about feel a pulse. It's a double-tech ambulance crew. They can't cannulate, they can't intubate, so they make a very sensible decision to get him in the ambulance and start driving towards the nearest major trauma centre. The other young man I want to tell you about is called Josh. He's also 15. He's meant to be at school, but he's not. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and Josh has fallen into perhaps bad company, and he's in the middle of a deal. The deal starts to go wrong. They hear police sirens coming, and Josh gets stabbed in the front of his chest. He runs away, he can hear the police coming, and he's trying to hide. He hides under a car. By the time the police find him, he's unconscious under the car. He's still breathing. His breathing is more grunting than breathing. The police pull him out, they phone for ambulance support, and an ambulance car arrives. His heart rate is 160, they can't feel a pulse. He's deathly white, and the veins in his neck are sticking up. So the blue phone goes in your emergency department, or the red phone in this case. You're going to receive a 15-year-old male who has a central chest stabbing, agonal respiration. He's going to be here in 12 minutes. Now, for some of us, 12 minutes is actually quite a long time for this sort of call. And I can't give you 12 minutes now. I'm just going to give you a few seconds just to think about what you would do. What would you prepare? Who would be on your dream team? Where are you going to take this trauma call? Now, whether you're a team leader, an SHO, whether you're the paediatrician who you probably come and do the safeguarding form, but whatever your role in treating adolescent trauma patients, I want you to think about what would you do now? Simon talked the other day about looking after yourself, your team, and your environment. So most people would be a little bit anxious when they got this call, especially if you're working in a paediatric trauma hospital, whether it's a children's hospital or a combined adult and paediatric major trauma centre, but particularly if you're working in an adult trauma centre. But what can you do? You can do the square breathing that Simon talked about. You can put your PPE on. You can quickly go to the toilet or grab a chocolate bar if you're feeling a little bit under the weather. And you can start to prepare. And most services have a checklist for how you get ready for these type of calls. And you can think about your team. Now, if you're the team leader, you may be worried about who's going to turn up as part of your team, who's competent to do whichever procedures might be required. But you've got a big decision to make. Are you going to put out an adult trauma call or a paediatric trauma call? So if you're working in a centre where you had those options, who would put out a paediatric trauma call? Okay, about half, 30%. Who would put out an adult trauma call for this? Quite a few people. Okay, now I would put out a paediatric trauma call because that's what we do, but actually I would probably quite like to put out an adult trauma call, and I'll show you why. The decisions you have to make are adult or paediatrics. Now, this 15-year-old, most of them sound a bit more like adults, and they're probably much closer to 70 kilos than they are to 10 kilos. You're going to have to think about where you take the call. You're going to take it in the paediatric bay, where you've got a whiteboard, you've got pink and blue cannulas, you may have some bubbles, or you're going to take it in bay 8 in our hospital, which is the serious trauma bay where the helicopter brings the patients in, where you've got surgical kits. You can do a thoracotomy, you've got operating lights, you can do Reboa, not that you would on a 15-year-old, but you've got all the kit you might need. You've got adult-sized anaesthetics machines and ventilators, you've got central lines, etc. The thing we're most worried about is that we might have to do this. And Simon talked about this. If you enjoy doing this, yes, I agree, Simon, you're a bit weird. But what you need to do is make sure that somebody in your team is competent to do this. And it's a big ask. A 15-year-old is a reasonable size. To get into their chest, you need to make an incision which is almost a foot long. So if you put out a paediatric trauma call, you're expecting someone in that team to be able to do it. Is that reasonable? The TARN data I described before, about the 25 patients that died, the 625 patients that came into hospitals, of that group, there were 4 thoracotomies done in those in England, Wales, and Ireland in the entire year last year. And there were 18 laparotomies. So if you're a paediatric surgeon working anywhere in the UK, pretty much, your chances of becoming really competent and confident at doing damage control surgery are fairly limited. In contrast, if you're an adult trauma surgeon, you're much more likely to undertake these procedures. To give you some more numbers, at the Royal London last year, we had 3,600 trauma calls. 400 of those were paediatric trauma calls. 120 adults had damage control surgery direct from the resus room, 12 children. And we work in a busy centre where 1 in 10 paediatric trauma calls is penetrating injury. So how can you get better? Who can you expect to actually do these procedures? And it's not just about surgery. The anaesthetist would probably feel the same. If you've been doing a lot of paediatric anaesthesia and you're suddenly asked to anaesthetize a 15-year-old who's completely collapsed, that's quite a change from what you've been doing every day for the last 6 months. Equally, if you're a PEM team leader, you've been looking after smaller children probably, maybe more minor traumatic injuries, but actually this is quite a step up for all members of the team. So how can we make sure people are trained in the right way? Well, there's some new and innovative training schemes, and actually PEM and emergency medicine try and make sure that our trainees cross over across the disciplines. But do we always make sure they get the best exposure and training? Do we make sure that our paediatric trainees come and watch adult trauma calls and see the fast pace that is required, the critical decision making, and the interventions when they actually occur? Equally, do we make sure that our adult trainees get the right experience when they move across to PEM? For surgeons and anaesthetists, there's some unique fellowships that have been set up, and as well as another plug for the Don't Forget the Bubbles Fellowship at the Royal London that's going to start. There's trauma training interface group fellowships for surgeons and for anaesthetists and emergency medicine trainees with national training numbers. And you can actually take a year out, have an NTN in major trauma, and you can go to a major trauma centre and be trained in a range of disciplines, including leadership and in procedural elements as well. So, for example, this year we've had an adult surgeon who's a colorectal surgeon by training come to the Royal London, and she's undertaken craniotomies, thoracotomies, about 80 laparotomies in her time with us, as well as team leadership training. So we're making a step forward to make sure that adult surgeons, anaesthetists, and team leaders are better equipped to look after younger children and adolescents. But equally, we need to support paediatrics and ensuring that you get that training from adults as well. So how about we collaborate? This is an example of an adult and paediatric team at the Royal London working together. And the key elements, as I said, are the team leadership, the surgical decision-making, and the anaesthesia. And you don't need to have the 11 people from paediatric trauma team plus the 11 people from the adult trauma team. You can just take the elements and combine them. In order to make this work when the patient arrives, you need to simulate this. You need to have pathways and processes agreed in advance. You need to determine where will this child be operated on if needed. Will you go to adult theatres or paediatric theatres? Now, that may depend on the time of day. For example, at the Royal London, we have 2 theatre teams available at night for adults, but only 1 paediatric team. So if you have a child that comes in the middle of the night and they're already operating in paediatrics, you may have to accept the child will go to adult theatres. So you have to make some decisions in a dynamic way. But you can train and simulate. Has anyone ever been to a simulation where the adult and paediatric teams are actually working together as part of the simulation? A few of you, but not many. We tend to simulate separately. Adult team on one day, peds on another day. But we could do more working collaboratively together. One area that we sometimes forget to simulate is the theatre teams. For patients like this, the move from ED up to theatre is absolutely critical. And we've all heard stories of things going wrong in lifts, of surgeons going up the stairs when actually the patient rearrests in the lift and someone needs to intervene. But actually, the scrub nurses find this extremely stressful when a large patient is brought to paediatric theatres, or conversely, they're expected to go to adult theatres to assist with the child. So it's just a little note, really. When you're doing simulation, try and remember the extra people who are very much part of the trauma pathway. Think about your theatre staff, your CT staff, your interventional radiology staff. So, remember the blue call that happened a few minutes ago? The good news is the HEMS team went to that patient. So actually, the thoracotomy has already been done. And this is a really good example of how, even if you didn't train to be a surgeon, you can actually train to do an emergency procedure. And all of the HEMS doctors and the paramedics who come through London's Air Ambulance are trained to do it on a very simple mannequin, not on a high-fidelity mannequin. And they're talked through the procedure, they're trained to do it. And most importantly, they absolutely believe that one day they will have to do it and someone's life will depend upon it. So if you are in a role where you think this might happen, and as I said, if you work in London, 1 in 10 paediatric trauma calls is a penetrating injury, and the surgeons might be busy. If you believe you might have to do this, there are courses you can go on to help you feel more confident and more competent. But anyway, the patient arrives, and your team is so slick because you've trained and you've simulated, and actually the patient goes up to the operating theatre where the scrub team have been involved in simulation. So it's all quite smooth. The patient goes to theatre. And again, you have to make a decision. Are they going to go to adult or paediatric intensive care? This will depend on your facilities, but it comes back to the issue we spoke about at the end of Russell's talk, which is we don't really have clear protocols for where these children should be managed. Should we have a specific adolescent intensive care unit? So then hopefully the child will go to the ward. Now they might go to a paediatric ward, which will be decorated beautifully, it'll be a nice environment, perhaps if you're under 12, but this isn't perhaps the environment that you want to put an adolescent into. Equally, the adult ward, very stark, clean, but very stark. And this is a really important area. We've done the critical care and the resuscitation, but as you know from the talk yesterday and the film by Armani, things have not finished. When I started working as an emergency physician, I was mostly interested in resuscitation and the exciting bit at the beginning. But actually, as my career's evolved, I've realised that for trauma patients to have good outcomes, recovery and rehabilitation are just as important as the resuscitation. Once the patient makes it to the ward, there's some really important conversations that have to happen. And we have a team called the After Trauma Team. One of the critical things that happens is whilst the patient is making their clinical recovery, they engage with multiple people. So this isn't just for penetrating trauma, because road traffic collisions and falls from height are still the commonest injuries in adolescents, but it's particularly important for penetrating trauma. We have a clinical psychologist who's available to all trauma patients. We have a patient liaison nurse who is funded by the London's Air Ambulance, and they come to visit patients and families. And they're particularly useful in filling in the gaps and explaining what happened at scene and trying to help people recover the little bit of their story that they've actually forgotten. And they can bring the pre-hospital team together with the patient to allow them to meet up. We also have a violence reduction team, which consists of trauma caseworkers. And I know there was a conversation yesterday about who should try and have these conversations with patients that have been stabbed or victims of interpersonal violence. And sometimes it is the doctors or the nurses. And if we have that opportunity, we should definitely seize it. But on many occasions, these young people don't want to talk to us as doctors or nurses about what has happened, what their life is like. And so it's really helpful to have someone who's slightly removed from the medicine to actually sit down with them, take the time. And in many cases, these caseworkers actually have personal experience and have empathy and authenticity when they're having these talks. These conversations are key, and not just with the patient, but also with the families. The families can suffer almost as much, if not more, in different ways than the patient. And actually having an environment where families can be supported, having space, having rooms, having facilities, will make all of this a lot easier. So Rayan, he and Josh both had pre-hospital thoracotomies. And the reason their cases are important to me are because I started working for the helicopter service in 2002, came back as a consultant in 2004, and it wasn't until 2012 that I had a thoracotomy survivor. Rayan was actually my first thoracotomy survivor. I wasn't the only doctor on duty. There were three HEMS doctors on duty that night, so I had some help. But Rayan survived. We opened his chest. We took him out of the back of the ambulance. We opened his chest. He had cardiac tamponade, which was relieved. He had a right ventricular wound, which was sutured. And he had a blood transfusion. 4 days later, I visited him in a major trauma center where he was playing on an Xbox on an adult ward. And happily, he went home to his family, his mum, dad, sister, and brother. And they came to visit us on the helipad. And I remember looking at his family standing on the helipad and just realizing, A, I was proud that we had saved his life and the system had worked for him, but B, the devastation that would have ensued to that family had he not survived if the system hadn't supported him. Josh's story is slightly different. Josh had almost identical injury to Rayan, cardiac tamponade, a right ventricular wound. We closed the wound, we gave him blood, his heart restarted. He went to the same hospital, he went to the same adult ward. Neither of them had further surgery in theatre, they just had their chest washed out, cleaned and closed. It turns out that Josh has been separated from his mum for a decade of his life. He only recently started living with his mum again. His dad is a member of a gang. And when he went to theatre at the hospital he was admitted to, they found 17 packs of drugs in his mouth, which shows how focused you can be when you're intubating a patient to not notice them on the way in. It wasn't me, but anyway. Josh was admitted to the adult ward. He was identified to be high risk. He was seen by the expected collaboration of the trauma caseworkers, of a psychologist, by the local education authority, and by social workers, and he was due to be rehoused. In the 6 months following his discharge, he was arrested twice for possession. And most recently, he's been knocked off a moped by a bus whilst being pursued by the police. So I think the message is that we can do a good job at adolescent trauma at the front end. We can resuscitate, we can save lives. But actually, if we haven't got the whole pathway completed, I think you can all get the feeling that Josh is not going to have the outcome that we would wish. So I would implore you that whatever your role, whichever type of hospital you work in, whether it's a major trauma centre or a trauma unit, there is definitely more we can do. Whether it's individual training, team training, simulation, pathway process, or just designing a better space for adolescents to be cared for in, there's something we can do. So collaboration is key. As a predominantly adult emergency physician, I'm very happy to support any paediatricians or paediatric surgeons, anaesthetists that want to do more trauma training. And equally, I would love to learn more from my paediatric colleagues. And I'm lucky to have very good colleagues, as you know, at the Royal London. So please feel free to collaborate with your other teams. Trauma is a team sport, and there's more than enough space for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anne. So we might take some questions from the floor for Anne. And Danny, you had a question as well, I believe.
So they keep coming. So here we go. Question number one. This is from Ard Rao. He says, how often is damage control treatment such as thoracotomy effective in pediatric and adolescent trauma? Is there outcome data for mortality and morbidity in such a rare procedure? Thanks from Sydney, he says.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So one of the problems with the data, as I said, is certainly in the UK, the only data that makes it into publications is TARN data. So you have to be admitted to hospital for 3 days. So there's a huge amount of data that's missed for patients. The average paediatric trauma patient in London actually spends 1 to 1.8 days in hospital, much less than the TARN criteria. So we miss a huge tranche of data there. And equally, patients who die outside hospital who've had thoracotomies by HEMS, that data isn't collected centrally. Air ambulances have their own information, but unless they choose to publish it, we don't really have an idea of what the overall survival rate is. What we do know from within London's air ambulance, our own survival rates, are that if you do the thoracotomy within 10 minutes of having signs of life, we have an 18% survival rate. It's obviously very difficult to determine that timeline initially, so sometimes we do it out with those parameters, but it's very clear. The reason you have to have someone who can do that procedure in an emergency department is if that patient is in arrest or peri-arrest, the longer you defer that procedure, your survival rate falls exponentially. So saying let's get them to theatre if they're already in arrest, or let's get them to a surgeon, doesn't work. It has to be done where the patient arrests. But we do know that if you have it done by a surgeon in a theatre, that's the optimum position.
Another question for you. So it's from Giles, saying, talking about challenges of getting PEM and PEDS trauma teams up skilled with a low volume but high acuity problem. And reflecting on what Russell was saying this morning, are we not missing an obvious win by moving the age range of PED trauma up to 18?
Yeah, thanks, Giles. Yeah, really, really good question. Happy for you to help. So I think it's really a question. I've thought a lot more about it since I've been preparing for this talk. And I think most people, certainly in our centre, will acknowledge the adult team gets 10 times more practice than the paediatric team. And you just notice the sort of slickness and the pace and pattern recognition. And I think we need to do something to try and share that learning between the adult and paediatric teams. We're in a very good position in London that we have both teams working in the same resus room. So there's a really good opportunity for crossover and specific debriefing and trying to include different people in different trauma calls. So I think we can do something quite special.
Fantastic. We've got a question down the front from Kia.
Hello. Thanks for a great talk. I remember the first thoracotomy that I ever saw, because it's the only thoracotomy I've ever seen. And it was obviously horrific for the family that was going through that with their 13-year-old child. But you talked a lot about the inexperience that we as paediatricians, particularly junior paediatricians, have in engaging with that sort of situation. And you talked very eloquently about the support networks that are in place for families who have gone there. And I just wondered if you had any reflections about support that may be needed for people who have got as far as ST7 or nurses who are paediatric trained, who are witnessing something that is pretty brutal, pretty eviscerating, and quite traumatic at work.
Yeah, thanks. That's a really important question. I guess I have two sides of experience for that. So when we do pre-hospital thoracotomies, they are some, and this is common age group, the commonest age to be stabbed in London is actually 16. So, and I know London is a bit different, but Bristol have doubled their instance of penetrating trauma in the last year, so it is spreading out, unfortunately, so it is relevant to everybody. But I think we often have families, friends, people watching us do thoracotomies in the street, and it doesn't pass us by that police officers, ambulance personnel, people are watching us for the first time. It's very abnormal to see the inside. I did warn Zia that there was a slide coming. It's very abnormal to see the inside of someone's body. Even when you're a trained doctor, if you haven't chosen to be a surgeon or a nurse, actually seeing that is quite disarming. We make big efforts to debrief. If we're unsuccessful at scene, we finish pronouncing life extinct, and then we will do a hot debrief with everybody there, and we make it very clear that this is not a normal thing to see. You might not feel quite right. You should see your GP, or we give out our own cards and say you can contact us if you want to talk about it. In hospital, we've developed our practice, and we tend to do a hot debrief, which is usually as soon as, if the patient's gone to theatre, once the theatre team are free to try and get anaesthetist, surgeon, scrub team back down to have a debrief. And then usually a week to 10 days later, we have a cold debrief to identify the real lessons learned and opportunities for systems improvement. But I think there's a real art, and I think it's important for team leaders and for senior nurses to keep an eye out for people in the team who look a little bit startled and to perhaps go to them specifically and take them aside, have a cup of coffee and actually talk about it, because it is really quite something to see that done quickly and especially on a child.
I believe we've also got another question up the back, please.
Hi. I just wanted to ask a question. I don't work in a major trauma centre, but I do work in London. And we do see sporadically trauma brought to our doors. How do we, as smaller units, maintain our skill set, bearing in mind that some of these interventions that need to be done are time critical, and that we are the ones who are going to have to stabilise before they can be shipped out to the major trauma centres?
Yeah,
keep our skills that are progressively dying up to date?
Good question. So whichever hospital you work in, you will be, I presume you're in a trauma unit as opposed to trauma centre, so you're part of a network. So your major trauma centre has an obligation to ensure that the trauma unit, or your network does, to ensure that you're adequately trained and supported. That might mean staff doing observer roles in MTCs, where you can't guarantee what you'll see, but you'll be given the opportunity to talk about it with other people who are doing it more often. Equally, access to training courses. And I think simulation, don't underestimate it. I'm not a big sim person, but I engage with them. There's experts who are here. But actually doing really simple simulation in your resus room, pretending you're doing a thoracotomy, making sure everyone knows where the kit is, not having a full thoracotomy kit, but having the three basic bits of kit that you need, you know, the scalpel, the Spencer Wells forceps, and some tough cut scissors. That's all you need. You don't need the full theatre set. Making things as simple as possible, making sure that you simulate, trying to keep current by going on courses and observing in an MTC, I think is all you can do. And the other thing to remember is if you're in a trauma unit, you can get on the phone and a consultant can talk you through that procedure. We've actually done that for other hospitals in London. We can talk someone through how to do it. Quite often it would be a surgeon because they're a bit more confident with the scalpel than a non-surgeon, but we can support the team, whether it's on FaceTime or just verbally or on audio, we can help you do it. And it has been done successfully in trauma units and the patients then being moved to the MTC.
Fantastic. We might have room for one more question from Twitter.
So from Felix Hay, who I've just got to say, Felix, wherever you are, I love your Twitter handle, Catman161. He says, are there any plans or opportunities for trauma skills training for ACPs in the pipeline that you're aware of?
I honestly don't know a huge amount about it, except we do have ACPs. And I think it's quite complicated, being really honest. I know they're expected to act at a similar level to ST3+. But I think actually this is a real challenge and something we have to decide which direction RKM want to take it as far as giving people surgical skills. And, you know, even as around being a team leader, that there's a huge amount of competencies that come automatically from your specialty training that allow you to be a team leader. And I think there is a role for ACPs, but I think we'll have to very carefully define it. And I'm not actually aware of any specific work, but someone else in the audience might know.
Can you join me again in thanking Anne Weaver? So I love that today we've had three fantastic talks about adolescent medicine, but it's not just been about taking care of adolescents, dealing with concussion and dealing with trauma. I love that each of Russell, Neha, and Anne have really taken that conversation bigger. So how can we look at the structure of the pediatric care system? How can we justify our quick diagnoses, and how can we help those further along the chain? And how can we keep our skills and maintain them in our day-to-day practice? So we might give you a little bit of an early mark because I've got a few little notices. The first is remember to do the CPR study. The morning tea is your last opportunity to be part of some groundbreaking Don't Forget the Bubbles research. Please have a little look at our LEGO ED hospital and feel free to make some tweaks and changes. If we've got something usable, we'll submit it to LEGO Ideas, and if we can muster enough upvotes, they will actually make it into a LEGO set that can be purchased. Finally, we've had a few questions about the beautiful stage. You are able to take photographs with it at the break, so I thought you might like a little bit of time for that. And finally, can I ask each of you to, in the spirit of space, repetition, and learning, give us a one-second puncher for what you'd like people to walk away with?
I thought you meant them, not us.
For me, it's young people at the heart of pediatrics.
Oh, damn.
Took the words out of her mouth.
For me, it's young people are going to get injured, and we have to be open and available to treat them wisely.
For me, it's adults and pediatrics should collaborate. Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Thank you, Danny.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy!